Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. War in Ukraine, fighting in Gaza, Lebanon, the Red Sea, and Israel, risky air and naval incidents in the South China Sea, worries about a potential Taiwan conflict, all of it wrapped in visibly growing tensions between China and Russia on the one hand, and the United States and its allies on the other. So much for the end of history and a lasting peace dividend. Once more, rival geopolitical blocs are maneuvering for advantage, competing directly and through proxies. Once more, economics is playing second fiddle to geopolitics. Countries are worrying about the security of their supply chains, and spending on armaments is growing rapidly. Is general war possible? Forget about history rhyming or not. Could we actually be stumbling towards something that looks remarkably like the hot and cold world wars of the 20th century? Philip Zelikow is an American diplomat and a scholar with decades of frontline experience thinking about and working on the great issues of war and peace. He recently published a deeply insightful article entitled Confronting Another Axis: History, Humility, and Wishful Thinking. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Welcome, Philip, to New Thinking for a New World.
Glad to be with you, Alan.
I try never to bury the lead, so I will start with yours from the Texas National Security Review article. Quote, "To me, a serious possibility of worldwide warfare may be only, your emphasis, in the 20 to 30% range." I found that an absolutely astounding statement. Have we really forgotten the lessons of the 20th century?
I think we tend to always assume, of course, that the future will be like the recent past. And I think what we've forgotten about the 20th century is not about the possibility of major war. What we've forgotten is how confusing and uncertain all those possibilities looked before they materialized. That how hard it was actually to interpret what the other side was thinking about, trying to do, and how complicated actually the twists and turns were then, and also in the period of greatest danger in the Cold War, which was between about 1948 and the end of 1962. And so since this is now the third period in American history where we have faced a purposeful set of adversaries short of all-out war, the others being the period between about 37 and the end of 41 and between 48 and the end of 62, I did think it was useful to reflect a little bit about that history, what really happened back then, to just try to instill a sense of humility for the current period, and then play that forward to call out actually some differences between the past episodes and this one. By the way, I don't myself refer to the current set of adversaries as another axis. In my article, I say confronting another axis ? I don't find the metaphor of an axis or the analogy to that to actually be all that helpful. I think it is really helpful, though, to probe what the stories were among those sets of adversaries back then, just to give us some sense of the uncertainty and surprises that we might face now.
Let me pull on that thread just briefly. Because it was only a few years ago when the notion of the other side no longer existed. The United States and China were moving towards some kind of new relationship driven by economics. Russia was viewed by many as an irrelevant power. President Obama talked about it as a middling-sized state and
yes,
more or less ignored it. So other side, adversaries, Should we be thinking of the Chinese and the Russians, perhaps some of their friends, the Iranians, the North Koreans, as adversaries? And Applebaum has recently been arguing that, yes, and indeed they have organized, they are organizing themselves as adversaries from a U.S., European, some other set of allied countries.
Oh, yes, they are a coherent set of adversaries, and they're quite conscious and purposeful, and they know it. The constant rebuke, which would be correct, would be, oh, well, they have different interests. They often don't like or trust each other. Yes. And so one of my points in the history actually is, 'twas always so. But the level of defense industrial collaboration, for example, the extent of the defense industrial collaboration between Russia, China, Iran, North Korea is actually a level well beyond what happened in the old axis, or even in the level of Soviet-Chinese cooperation in the 1950s. So, but I think their political objectives, you know, it's not like they're concerting a giant coordinated secret master plan. But they have fundamentally core goals in common, as did those other collections of adversaries. In each of these cases, including the present one, what they have in common is what they resent. What they have in common is a resentment of a world order that they think stifles them, that constrains their ability to become what they wish to become. A world order that they think is led by the United States, which enlists various allies to help stifle and constrain them, to keep them from becoming what they want to become. A world order that they think is cloaked in pieties and hypocrisies from their point of view, and which they want to overthrow and bring in a new world order. And actually, in the thousands of words of the Russo-Chinese joint statement in February 2022, just before Russia invaded Ukraine, they go into some detail and have in other settings about what their world order looks like. And it's mainly, see, they claim that their world order is a world order of equality and sovereignty. They argue that this world order is one of great power hierarchies and dominance and oppression, and that the world order they represent, representing, they claim to represent the have-nots of the world. And what they want then is a world that doesn't have this kind of great power hierarchy, they claim, and in which every country is sovereign, free of interference. Everybody can trade without sanctions and all of this. And there's none of this judgmental stuff.
They also use the word democracy a lot and use it with very different definitions.
Yes. From their point of view, and this has roots in their political cultures and all of these societies. It's interesting, you know, that, you know, people often say that hypocrisy is the homage that vice plays to virtue and pays to virtue. And in this case, they all like to use the term democracy. And they say the real democracy is the democracy that that advances the people's interests. See, we regard democracy in a very process-oriented way. Democracy is a set of processes in which people have elections and courts enforce a rule of law. Their view of democracy is, and this has some roots in Marxist objective materialism, is the true democracy is whatever form of government most advances the well-being of most of the people. The people rule when the people's interests are being materially served. And their argument is that their forms of government are more effective in serving the people and the people's interests, and that therefore their forms of government are truer democracies.
As you point out in your article, over the course of the 20th century, 50 years of hot war, brief interruption, a Cold War that follows after, although it was much hotter than people remember that Cold War. But that is a different point. But in each of those cases, the adversaries of the U.S. and its allies felt, your word, constrained, felt contained, and eventually built up enough both strength and perhaps possibilities, maybe even animosities as well, to do something about it.
Yeah.
And as you've written, your sense is that they are feeling boxed in. They are feeling that explicit American strategy is indeed to contain.
Yes.
And clearly, as we've seen during the Ukraine war, the willingness to use economics.
Yes.
Seizures, sanctions, et cetera, is being implemented on steroids. The United States really is trying to reshape how the global economy works. I suspect if I was sitting in Beijing or Moscow or Tehran or some other places, to the detriment of those countries. How close do you think we are to the point where the pushback gains momentum?
I want to clarify that even though I try to describe their views in ways that make it sound like I sympathize with them, what I'm doing is I'm trying to understand their perspective. I don't agree with it. But let me, you have accurately summarized.
Terribly important point, because you can't be a great chess player if you don't understand how the other guy is looking at the board. You will indeed fail.
Oh, once upon a time, many years ago, I was a trial and appellate lawyer. And you cannot be a good trial lawyer if you can't make the other side's arguments about as well as you can make your own.
Absolutely.
But now to come back to your observation about the moment of history we're in, you're right about the resentments. But you made another comment earlier that was also right. You made a comment about their sense of feeling more empowered. I think that really, especially since the global financial crisis, the late 2000s, this group of countries has actually been feeling more and more as if history is changing and that the moment for kind of toppling the old order and demonstrating that there is now a new order, that moment is arriving, that the American-led order is more and more losing its legitimacy, its stature, it's disintegrating from within, and that the moment has come. And so in a way, Putin in some ways has always been the most energetic and risk taker in this group. And so in the 2014 initial invasion of Ukraine, and then of course the 2022 invasion, which really rung up the curtain. And then Russia has been in this group the most entrepreneurial in organizing the coordination of the common defense industrial base. Though the Chinese, especially since the beginning of 2023, have played a very significant part then in that enterprise. So it is a combination of longstanding and growing and festering resentments, then combining with a sense of and now the time has come. And in a way, the main question of the moment is, how do they think about the timing? They're all preparing for war. China, as much as any, they are preparing for war, for large-scale war. They're preparing for it in every way, including in their public culture. And so the question, in a way, you ask then is, and then they ask themselves, is this the time? Is this year the year? Or is it next year? And how long will it be next year? And I don't know the answer to that. I point out that in the past, the leaders in the past that were in these groups of adversaries also didn't really have firm answers to those questions and often made those decisions quite opportunistically based on factors that outsiders at the time didn't even really understand. And that sense of humility ought to caution us today, says we don't know when they'll decide now is the time, say for the move on Taiwan, to step up the final settlement of accounts with Israel, other things.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on talbergfoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
That's the difference between strategy and tactics, in part. It is the difference between having a vision but being opportunistic. You make in your article and implicit in what you said a couple of points that are important to draw out. One is they have a strategy. Does the West have a strategy?
It doesn't have as coherent and purposeful a strategy. I don't want to. It's easy to make the enemy seem too tall and make our side seem like quarrelsome pygmies. That would go too far. They for sure, though, they have a general sense of common cause, and they talk to each other constantly. And we know very little about what's said in those conversations. So we can see the sense of common cause, and we can see a variety of kinds of cooperation. The Chinese is the most important variable, and I fundamentally don't know how the Chinese are judging and calculating. My argument in the article is that I think actually the greatest dangers may be sooner rather than later, which is not the conventional wisdom, but that's my argument. But on the other side, on our side, your question was, do we have a coherent strategy? I think there is a fairly strong coherent strategy that we want to somehow try to stop, keep Russia from defeating Ukraine. Then there's a lot of arguments about how best to do that and whether we've calibrated our strategy the right way. But I think there is a relatively solid core common strategy among the G7 countries to try to keep Russia from defeating Ukraine militarily and economically. And I've been involved in a lot of this work, especially on the economic side, involved especially to do with the issue of what to do with frozen Russian state assets. But the commonality has been getting greater on China, mostly on a growing consensus towards kind of the sterilization of some of the Western interactions, economic interactions, and export controls with China. And that's changed actually quite a lot even in the last year. And there's a growing sense of solidarity in standing up to China, including in East Asia, that the Biden administration has very effectively promoted and led, but that the Biden administration would be the first to concede that the big leader of this coalescence against China is China. That China has provoked people to rally because they're very anxious. On Iran and the Middle Eastern vector or the North Korean vector, those are really their own stories, and there's not much of a common strategy, except that the continuation of the sanctions regime against Iran and North Korea, more or less kind of a lot of it driven by inertia. But the net result, when you step back, is increasingly significant portions of the world economy and finance are already now being divided into two worlds. There is an economic and financial world in which the Chinese, Russians, Iranians, and North Koreans all trade with each other and their friends. And then there is another world in which the Americans, Europeans, and Japanese can trade relatively unconstrained with their friends. And that world has crystallized in the last 2.5 years. And increasingly, there's also now a common military dimension. I do think that the strategy on our side is fundamentally reactive, and the strategy on their side is fundamentally proactive. That is, they have the strategic initiative. In general, that's true for Russia and China. I think the Iranians think that they are actually in somewhat more of a reactive, defensive mode. I think, I'm not saying they're right about that, but I think that they think that.
I suspect that's true. You mentioned Taiwan, an obvious flashpoint. And one of the things I absolutely loved about your article, as I've told you, are the footnotes. And I've been going down the Taiwan rabbit hole footnotes, and the serious work that's being done on the possibility of a conflict over Taiwan is devastating in economic terms.
Yes, that you're quite right to call that out, and you're quite right to call that out as an important dimension of my article. Ordinarily, these discussions are overwhelmingly in military terms. And I'm very sensitive to the economic and financial dimensions of this struggle. And I make the point that actually in a couple of these cases, the military options are very problematical and the economic and financial options are substantially unexplored. And since the military options are problematic and the economic options are unexplored, that to me has an obvious lesson for policy, is that we ought to lean a little less on one and do a lot better in working on the other. And your observation then is important, in that it's not well recognized that even a very small war between the United States and China that's just limited to a specific area is likely to cause a global economic catastrophe. Because as soon as Chinese start killing Americans and Americans start killing Chinese, even if on a small scale, very quickly, like within hours and days, a variety of things will happen that will freeze the ability of Chinese and Americans to conduct financial transactions with each other. And it will end up freezing and even possibly seizing assets of the other side that are in their jurisdiction. And then when you work through the counterparty implications of all of that and the cascade of, you know, this happening at a level of trillions of dollars, the economic consequences are profound from even a very small war. And then the argument would be, I wonder if the Chinese understand this. I won't go into detail. I'll just say I think they do. Question, does the United States and its allies understand this? In my view, not so much. I don't think that they have fleshed out then all the scenarios and options. So there's a danger there that actually, as they understand that, that becomes a powerful form of deterrence helping the Chinese. Is we're deterred from intervening in a situation because of the fear of economic calamity, not just our worries about the military outcomes. And then part of my argument is, well, you at least better work the economic side really hard, and it may turn out that we can actually fortify ourselves for such a situation more effectively than the Chinese can. And if that turns out to be true, then the economic danger becomes a deterrent on our arsenal, in our arsenal, and not in the Chinese arsenal.
I would tend to argue that the Chinese understand how important Taiwan is economically to them and have almost no interest in an invasion. I have air quotes on that. They might have an interest in a blockade, in trying to cut off Taiwan from the rest of the world, in trying to make it more costly. But even that, your argument remains the same, would probably very quickly trigger all sorts of sanctions and seizures and other actions that would have a catastrophic impact on the global economy.
Yeah, you're right. But let me just kind of, I explain in the article a scenario in which that actually works against us, not them. A lot of people use the term blockade and don't really understand the difference between a blockade and a quarantine or version of indirect control. So the first Berlin crisis in 48, 49, that was a blockade. We're going to cut off food and coal, see if we can force you out of Berlin. The second Berlin crisis between 1958 and the end in 1963 was not a blockade. It was a threat to cut off foreign access to West Berlin. Foreign access. They weren't going to cut off food and coal to the West Berliners. They were offering the West Berliners a free city. The whole goal was to say, you foreigners, you foreign military forces, you have to stay out of West Berlin. And we're going to deny access to you. So that scenario translated into the present situation is one in which the Chinese say, trade with Taiwan is fine. It's just that we're going to set up border controls, since Taiwan is part of China, in which we'll control the foreigners who get to come to Taiwan. Foreign arms, foreign missiles, foreign soldiers, foreign airmen. We need to police that from coming into Taiwan because it's part of our country. But normal trade with Taiwan goes on just fine. Then if you in the West want to attack our border controls, well, all the consequences of you doing that will be on you, not on us. We're not interfering with trade. You'll be the ones who will trigger the escalation if you interfere with our border controls that are only targeting the foreigners. Now you have a situation that's much more like the second Berlin crisis, which was why it was so dangerous. In that crisis, the burden of threatening escalation was actually on the United States. In the scenario I've just described, the burden of escalation is on the United States and its allies. See, at that point, the Chinese say, if you cause this trouble, well, then we can blockade Taiwan. We'll have to cut off maritime traffic to Taiwan, but you'll be causing that problem, not us. And then then all the pressure tends to run is, please, America, don't do that. Please don't cause the blockade, because we, Taiwan, are going to be the net losers of the blockade. And then if the Taiwanese to challenge the blockade. See, at every step in the escalation ladder, China dominates. But the whole burden of triggering the escalation, they could put on us.
And it's important to stress that us in that case has potential to fissure, there to potential to crack. The us is US and Europe and Japan.
Right. And if the Japanese and the Europeans won't join us in challenging the Chinese border controls, which, remember, might be targeted only at foreigners, only at foreign contraband. If they won't join us on that, our options don't look so appealing, including our options for any sort of economic retaliation. Remember, this is occurring in a context of international law in which all these countries have nominally recognized that there is only one China. None of them have recognized Taiwan as an independent country. So the Chinese international legal position is blurry.
I would have made the case that the American legal position is a little blurry. But that would be impolite to a former American official.
You can run that argument either way. So Now, so some people then say, yes, but then it'll all be China's fault for everything that happens, and they won't take the... China won't embark on that course unless it feels ready to master each step in the escalation ladder. But the fundamental point about that course is that the fundamental burden of escalation, they could argue military escalation, will actually be on us, not on them. And then we can make our arguments about who's at fault, but when it comes to the actual actions in the field, that's going to be on us. And then that was the fundamental problem of the Second Berlin Crisis. And ultimately, the Second Berlin Crisis relied on the United States' assertion of its readiness to start a nuclear war if needed to protect Berlin. And of course, that's the kind of option that's not available to us now.
Not available in many dimensions, not the least given the quality and tenor of our domestic, U.S. domestic political discussion about these issues, which is more or less non-existent.
Yeah, I mean, especially at the level you and I are talking about, hardly anyone, even many people who follow international affairs, are engaging the issue at this level of detail and sophistication. Though I promise you, there are people in our government who are aware of my arguments.
I both assume so and hope so, but I don't know if my assumption is larger or smaller than my hope. But it is essential that maybe we end with that.
And let me just clarify, too, is that I'm arguing, and as you know, I argue in the article, these are serious possibilities. I'm not saying this is what's going to happen. I can make a perfectly good argument about how this will all work out in a relatively benign way. And that may even be more likely than not. But I am arguing that these dangers are serious enough possibilities that as a policy matter, you have to plan for them. You have to have your hedge, you have to have a strategy for them. You can't just assume that they can't happen. That's the humility I counsel in my article. And at some level, it doesn't really matter whether the percentage that they happen is 20% or 50%. Really, after you get above a certain threshold, you have to plan for it. You have to, and I think our plans for these scenarios are not where they need to be.
I think that is certainly true. But even more, I think back to 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, when the notion that the world had all died and gone to heaven, that indeed we were living in an era of it was the 60s again, right? Peace, love, understanding, commonality, that's gone.
Yeah, that's gone.
It was never really there, and neither you nor I ever thought it was there, but it was the popular assumption. Every banker friend I knew then lived in that world, hence they did things that bankers shouldn't have been doing in lots of countries. But that's gone. So is there a new realism beginning, not just in among strategists, but among political leaders, among business leaders, and not just in the United States, but more generally, because your argument essentially is that if only the strategists get it, it's Maui bar the door time.
You know, I am actually nostalgic for the era of what I call the global commonwealth after 1990. I think we had a generation that was actually a blessing for the world. You can see it actually in the data on world incomes, on material well-being of billions of people in the world improving in every way, health, income. I think, yeah, and of course, all times have their troubles, but that was a good period. I think it's a tragedy, and I think a tragedy for which the United States is not principally responsible, that we've now entered this new era. But we have entered this new era, and we're in it. And what I hope is that, and I argue, is that we can head off the dangers of this new era without another worldwide war. I think that's possible. I think the next few years are the zone of maximum danger.
I could go on for another half an hour, hour, day, because what ought to be done and who should be doing what to minimize that danger. probably should be the subject of our next conversation, not the extension of this one. So, Philip, thank you very much.
Oh, gosh, thank you, Alan. It's a wonderful talking with such a literate colleague.
Thank you very much for that. Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.